Today's scripture is John 11, 28 through 35. When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, "The teacher is here, and he is calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary get up and quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to weep. The word of God for the people of God.
So yesterday, we had a bit of an experience in our family that is incredibly rare. And if any of you are kind of modern parents or grandparents with, you know, school-age kids, you know how rare it is to have a day where there is literally nothing on the calendar. Like, zero things. We woke up that morning, and we actually had all the kids, because my stepkids split time between our house and with their dad. And so we had all of the kids home, that at least still live in the home, and we were going to see Gavin later that night. And we got up and looked at our calendar and said, "Okay, what do we got to do today?" And Emily looked at me, and she's like, "Nothing." I'm like, "Nothing? Like, there is not an appointment. There is not a volleyball game. There is not a play practice. There is not a play date with some kid who lives, you know, two towns away." There was nothing on the calendar. And she's like, "Well, what are we going to do?" And immediately you start to think of all of the chores you can get done, right? Like think about all the things we can clean, all the things we can do, right? I mean, it's just, we have a whole day and we have these three able-bodied young people who live in our home and don't pay rent. They should do chores. That idea lasted for about 2 minutes until I was reminded that the house was actually fairly clean already and that, you know, we don't get these days very often. So maybe the thing we should do is not try to figure out how to fill this day full of tasks. Maybe what we should do, since apparently winter is canceled and it's a nice sunny day outside on Saturday, if you didn't notice, we got a little bit of winter on Friday and that was about it. Apparently that's all we're getting. I hope you enjoyed it. Sorry, Dave. So Dave likes to ski. He's out of luck. Anyway, so we said, well, maybe we could, you know, do stuff together. Like, well, I don't know, what could we do? Anyway, so Emily and her daughter read a book for a little while they've been wanting to read, and then they watched the TV miniseries version of it for a little bit. And then once everybody was kind of up and we had a nice big breakfast that we made together, we're like, let's go to the park, right? Let's just go do something that we can just do together. And it doesn't cost us anything, and we'll just do that. We're like, okay, so we're Googling, you know, best parks in northern Colorado, and we end up at this one main park in Windsor that was super fun, and we had a great time there, but then we had a little bit of time left to kill, so we found this other park in Loveland, and so we ended up going over there. And when we got there, clearly this is a brand new one, and it has all of these, like, modern play equipment that I realize I am too dumb to know how to play with. Right? Because there's no merry-go-rounds or seesaws anymore. Like, those are all gone. But now they have all these new contraptions that, quite seriously, I don't know how they work. And Emily and I actually sat on one and tried to make this thing work that had two places to sit and this bar in between. And it looked like a physics problem, not like a toy you're supposed to play on. We couldn't make it do anything. And we're like, well, this is kind of dumb. So we wandered off, went around to different places. But when we wandered back, suddenly there was this whole gaggle of kids around this piece of equipment, and there was a dad, and he had figured out basically how to make it work. And we watched this for a little while, and we're like, that doesn't actually look that hard. If you kind of pull down on this end, then that end goes up. And then we waited, and then we waited, and we waited, because these kids were having such a good time, they kept taking turn and turn and turn and turn. And finally, right before we probably needed to go, they all kind of left, and we're like, now's our chance. And we descended on it. I must confess, it was quite fun, right? I think we have a picture. Yes, so here is Vivian, my daughter, on one side, and Emily and her daughter on the other side. And I felt really good that Vivian did not launch her stepmother into the stratosphere, even though she probably could have if she wanted to. And we had a grand old time at the park. And one thing I noticed while we were there on this nice, beautiful day in this park is that parks are designed for you to be present, right? Like, that's what you do. Your only thing to do when you're at the park is to be present. It's to be there and to enjoy whatever it is that is in front of you. And if you can't figure out how to make the stupid thing work, then you move on to something else that you can, right? But that is really the whole purpose of these whole areas that we set up. They are built for us to be present in. They're not for getting work done, though I'm sure you could go work there if you wanted to. They are for being with nature, and they are for being with the people you are with and being present with each other. And I had this moment because I knew we were talking about this on Sunday morning, and I wondered, and I started to look around, and I realized that while we were there, and there were several dozen other families and older people and people with dogs and all that kind of stuff wandering around in the park, what I noticed very clearly and actually was very surprising to me is that literally of those dozens and dozens and dozens of people, almost nobody was on their phone. They were interacting with the kids or the grandkids. They were walking the dog. They were talking to their neighbors. They were doing all of those sorts of things. I only, as I was looking around, saw two people on their phone. One was a grandpa that was clearly taking a break from whatever it is the grandkids were trying to make him do and making some excuse about needing to check the weather or something. And one was quite obviously the bored girlfriend of one of the gentlemen skating at the state park who I'm sure she thought could have been done a little while ago, right? Those were the only two people. And in fact, I realized this morning that this is actually a screen grab of a video that I shot because that's the only picture I took, the whole time because we were too busy being present with each other to remember to even take pictures to post on Instagram. And if you didn't post it on Instagram, did it really happen? Yes, it did. Presence. Presence is hard. There is so much in life to distract us. There's so many things that we know we could or should be doing at any one time, right? So that the idea of taking time to be present with each other, wherever it is we happen to be, however it is we happen to be. Vivian was nursing a sore back the whole time we were there. She still has one today. So we were trying to figure out how to help her play, but not take it out too far. And yes, she did fall down once, and that was kind of my fault. Again, I don't know how to use these things. And I used it wrong, and my daughter paid the price. Like a good parent. Anyway, so we have these places and these times, right, where we recognize the importance of being present with each other in whatever shape or condition we happen to be in that moment. Without trying to fix anything, without trying to do anything, without trying to accomplish anything other than have an enjoyable afternoon in some really odd, sunny March day. Presence is important. It's too easy in life to get sucked into the to-do list. It's too easy in life to be overcome by our calendars. It's too easy in life to think that all the fun and all the important things are happening other places and I'm not a part of it, so I got to check the news every 5 minutes to figure out what's going on in the world because clearly there's something bigger and more important than what I'm doing right now. The story of Jesus going to see Martha and Mary after the death of Lazarus is a story about presence. It's a story about Jesus choosing to be present with the people he loves and he cares about before he does anything else. Now, this story starts, I realize we kind of started in the middle, but this story starts with Jesus getting word that his good friend Lazarus is sick. And not only sick, but very sick. And of course, they are living in a time before hospitals and doctors and nurses and all those sorts of things. So this was not usually a good sign. And so Jesus gets word. And interestingly, if you back up the scriptures and read that part of the story, Jesus gets word that his friend Lazarus is sick, but he doesn't immediately go to him. He actually goes somewhere else for a couple of days before then turning around and heading to where Lazarus and his sisters, Martha and Mary, are. Now, Martha and Mary, we know, right? We know from the other gospel story with Martha and Mary. So if you remember that story, good, but we're going to get there in a minute. So Jesus goes, and when he finally arrives at this place, it is Martha is the one who rushes out of the house to visit her. Now, if you remember in the other Martha and Mary story, Martha is the one who is busy in the kitchen, taking care of all the things, and is being annoyed at her sister Mary because her sister Mary is simply sitting at the feet of Jesus being present. And in that story, Martha gets a little bit of a talking to by Jesus, saying, actually, Mary being present with me chose the better option. And so here again, we have Jesus showing up and Martha again being the one in action. She is the one that gets activity. By the way, I know we've talked about the Martha and Mary story, and I said it then, I'll say it now. Martha gets a bad rap because sometimes you got to get stuff done, right? The engineer in me says sometimes the time is clean the dang kitchen, right? But that's a whole other sermon. Anyway, so Martha as the active one shows up. She goes and finds Jesus. Martha really is living out what we talked about last week, right? The person needs, first you need to take action. You need to size up what's going on. Well, Martha has done that. She has sized up what's going on. She knows the score. She knows what happened, and she knows that Jesus is there now. And if only Jesus had been there a couple of days earlier, she is convinced that Lazarus would have lived. But as it is, he's actually already been gone for 4 days by the time Jesus showed up. Meaning that even if Jesus had left immediately from where he was, he would not have made it there in time as far as Martha was concerned. Because again, there are no cell phones, there are no, you know, telegraphs even. Word does not travel very quickly. So by the time Jesus even is told that that Lazarus is sick, chances are he's already gone. So Jesus goes to Martha and says, and they have this little exchange we just read today. And the first thing Jesus does is he receives this word from Martha and he receives Martha. And then they go and they get Mary, who has been at home, being present with the others who are no doubt grieving the loss of this important person. And they go and they find Mary and they are there together. And then initially, they want to do what it is they think they're supposed to do. They want to take action. They want to do something. And the thing that they can do is take Jesus to see where Lazarus has been laid. But if you notice, there's a quick little thing in there. There's a quick moment that goes by quick, but we can't let it go by quick. We need to keep it. We need to take a moment with it. And it's after Jesus finally learns he's together with Martha and Mary. He's together with these two people he cares about. He's together with them. He sees the grief. He sees the loss. He sees that there's a whole community. Remember, these are small little communities. Everybody knows everything. It's like Johnstown 20 years ago. I wasn't here, but so I've heard. I'm the problem. I'm sorry. But everybody knows. Which means that when something good and amazing happens and there's a wedding or a birth or something like that, everybody gets to enjoy it together. But when there is a loss, it is felt by all. And so Jesus stands there amongst these people, still feeling and reeling this loss that they didn't see coming, and they're feeling very acutely. And they're saying, Jesus, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go to the tomb. There is a verse there that in the original Greek, the entire verse in the original Greek is only two words. And the verse is, Jesus wept. Not Jesus felt sorry for the people who were sad. Not Jesus saw what was going on and acknowledged their pain and their grief. No, he didn't just see it. He didn't just come to be there and watch what they were doing. It says very clearly that Jesus himself wept. He saw the grief of the people. He saw the challenges they were going through. He saw the struggles that they were having. And instead of keeping his distance, instead of keeping himself separated, instead of saying, well, that has nothing to do with me because I know what I'm about to do. And if you've read ahead in the story, you know what he's about to do. Instead, he sees and experiences the feelings of the people around him so much so that he himself is moved to weep. He's weeping for the pain that everyone around them is experiencing. He is weeping for the loss that everyone feels. He is weeping for the fact that these folks don't yet know the hope that he came to bring them. And instead of getting upset with them, instead of saying, "Why are you weeping? Don't worry about this. I'm going to take care of it," it says Jesus wept. God knows when we struggle. God knows when we are in pain. God knows when we grieve. God knows when those things happen in our lives that we truly wish would not and could not and should not happen. And the hope we find in this passage is in those moments, God is present with us in a real and honest way. Jesus joins the people in their grief. Jesus wept. Now, as I was thinking about this passage, I was thinking about that importance and the power of people simply just showing up and being with you. People just showing up and being present at times when you need somebody to be present. Oftentimes, the thing that we want more than anything when our life is falling apart is just something or some hand or someone to hold on to. One of the hardest things that I had to learn in seminary when I did my pastoral care education and my internship is they would send me out to go and do pastoral care visits and visit with people in the hospital or people who were in hospice or, you know, whatever the situation is. And the hardest thing I had to learn when I walked into those rooms, especially like at the hospital rooms with all that stuff, is there wasn't really anything I could do to fix whatever it was that was causing that person to be there. I am not a doctor, I am not a nurse, I'm not barely qualified to put a Band-Aid on your knee. So I struggled in the beginning. I'm like, what am I even doing here? I can't help. Why do they want me here? I can't do anything. They need doctors and nurses and caregivers and all that kind of stuff. What good is this random guy gonna do showing up to be present in your hospital room making small talk with you? And my pastor, mentor at the time, began my education on the importance of presence. Is your job is to be present in those times. Your job is to be there with them. Your job is to embody the same kind of presence that God has for each one of us in physical form in that time. And there are people who do my job, there are people who do the clergy job and do this, choose to do it as a profession, and we call them chaplains. And chaplains are specifically trained in like some extra, specifically trained to be present. That is their role and that is what they do. And as I thought about that, I was thought about a guy named Michael. Michael was born in 1933 in Depression era New York. His father passed away when he was only 6 years old. He had to become a shoeshine boy in order to help support his family. We used to have those. He was too young, clearly, only born in 1933. He was too young to be drafted into World War II, but really just began his life growing up on the rough and tumble streets of New York. And while he was there, he had need of and encountered many different ministries of the church. And one of the things that he encountered were a group of, I'm pretty sure they were Franciscan friars. And the work that they were doing in the streets, ministering to people in the late 40s and early 50s. And Michael saw this work and he was inspired. And he's like, that's what I want to do. That's the life that I want to live. I want to not only be a priest, but I want to be a priest of the streets. I want to be present where people are. I want to take this good news that I know and take it to these far-flung places. And so he dedicated his life to that task. And it's what he did. He eventually went to seminary, he became ordained in the Catholic Church, and he was appointed to several different parishes all around New York. And usually the parishes you did not want to get appointed to. Not the cushy, cozy appointments like Johnstown United Methodist Church. You all are lovely. These are the hard scrabble congregations in difficult places on the front lines at a time when New York was not full of the M&M store and Broadway as we know it today. So he found his life there, and he found his courage there, and he really enjoyed the work that he was doing there, and he did find purpose and calling in it, recognizing that most of the time, he couldn't actually do much to solve people's problems, but he could be present for them. He could offer care and comfort for them. And when the AIDS crisis struck through New York in a terrible way in the 80s, and they started to create the first AIDS hospitals, Father Michael was one of the first people through the door to offer spiritual care and comfort to people who no doubt felt abandoned by their families and abandoned by the church. There's a story that one person says of Father Michael. He says, I saw him one day sitting with a patient at one of these hospitals, and this patient looked up at him and he says, do you think God hates me? And Father Michael took him by the hand, kissed him by the forehead, and rocked him until he fell asleep. He was present in a real and important way for folks that the rest of the world didn't want anywhere near them. And this is what he did over and over and over again. Until in 1992, he got a new appointment, and the appointment he got in 1992 was to be a chaplain for the New York Fire Department. So larger departments oftentimes will have chaplains on staff, right? They'll put them on staff, they'll be there, you get called in. Sometimes a lot of clergy pastor friends that I have, they'll serve as volunteers, but they go and they truly are first responders oftentimes when really not great things are going on. And their job is different than the police and the fire and the medics who show up. Right? Their job is to make sure that people's spiritual and mental needs are being cared for while whatever tragedy is unfolding around them. Right? Their job is to be present. Their job is to be a calm center in a place that calls out for anything but calm. And so he trained as a chaplain. He became a chaplain for the Fire Department of New York. And people were reminded that unlike other chaplains who might keep a little bit distance, he chose to actually sleep at the firehouse so he could be there as soon as he could be whenever a call came in. They talked about how he used to carry around this roll of $1 bills in his pocket to hand out to anyone he thought might need one when he was out working in the streets and doing the things that he did. And there are countless stories over and over and over again of people going through hard and difficult times about how he was one of the ones who showed up. And while everyone was taking care of everybody's bodily needs in that moment, whatever the crisis be, car accident or whatever, he was there to hold hands, to corral children, and to give some kind of reassurance, whatever reassurance could be given. And because he was a chaplain in New York, and because he was there on September 11th, 2001, after the plane struck the first tower, he made his way immediately to the lobby of the other tower because he knew there would be people in panic. And they knew while they were doing all the important things they needed to do to evacuate people and bring them out of there, that somebody was going to need to be the calm center. Somebody was going to need his presence. Somebody was going to need the peace. And so he went very early in that morning, and he was one of the first, if not the first person through the door. And when they set up the emergency base camp for the New York Police Department, for the New York Fire Department on the ground floor of the other tower, it was him and several others who were there at the moment the first tower collapsed. Father Michael is recorded as victim 0001 of the New York Trade Center. It was a day later that they could recover him. After the dust settled and people began to tell the story of what happened, they said he died exactly how he lived, not by fixing anything, but by standing beside the broken until the very end. Presence. Being present with each other. Being present when times are good and being present when times are not good is oftentimes not only the only thing we can do, but it's the best thing we can do. As Methodists, we understand this because John Wesley understands this because before Father Michael was the priest of the streets, John Wesley was. And one of the things that he baked into us as people, as Methodists, is this idea of social holiness. And social holiness is oftentimes misunderstood. What social holiness means in terms of John Wesley and what he thought about it is an understanding that our faith is the most real when it is connected to others. Our faith is the most real when it is connected to others. We do not practice our faith in isolation. We practice it together as a community, whether physically present or just emotionally so, however it is that we can be connected to one another, that is what we do. So normally, while I like to end my sermons oftentimes with a call to action, I'm going to give you instead a call to inaction, a call of being present with one another, a call to take the time and that empty spot in your calendar and not fill it with tasks and to-dos, but ask yourself the simple question, who haven't I seen in a while? Whom would I like to give a hug? Whom would I like to receive a hug from? What friend have I not talked to on the phone for many days, but I miss them and I want to know what's going on? A call to presence, a call to an inaction, a call to do nothing more and nothing less than to accept, love, and cherish the peace and grace and comfort that God gives us, and then find whatever way we can to embody that peace and that comfort and that grace with each other. Amen.